is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil. U.S. President Donald Trump Monday described hundreds of thousands of federal civil servants working without pay during the partial government shutdown as great patriots, but there was no movement toward ending the record 31-day closure of a quarter of U.S. government operations. Mr. Trump renewed his call for a wall along part of the U.S.-Mexican border. About 800,000 federal workers have been affected by the shutdown, with more than half ordered to continue working without pay and the rest sent home. But that number might be changing as workers hurt by missing paychecks seek alternate sources of income. As AP's Julie Walker reports, one such group is the Transportation Security Administration.
The TSA has been experiencing far higher unscheduled absences during the shutdown, with workers not getting paid. Kicking off this busy MLK holiday with 8% of employees skipping work on Saturday compared to 3% a year ago. That forced screening areas to close at some airports, including BWI in Baltimore, where one of the three checkpoints had to be shut down. Still, TSA reports nationwide most passengers waited less than 30 minutes. It expects 8 million travelers to pass through its checkpoints over the long holiday weekend. I'm Julie Walker.
Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir is set to go to Qatar this week. It is his first overseas trip since widespread anti-government protests rocked the nation. Bashir will arrive on Tuesday and meet with Qatar's emir, and on Wednesday to discuss ways of boosting relations. That's according to Qatar state news agency QNA on Monday. Bashir has tried to downplay the protests, insisting that foreign agents and infiltrators are responsible for the dissent, as well as the violence that has followed, which has resulted in several deaths or many deaths. This is VOA News. The European Union has imposed sanctions on Russian military intelligence chiefs over the nerve agent attack on a former Russian double agent in Britain last year. EU foreign ministers meeting in Brussels Monday slapped travel bans and asset freezes on four Russians, including the head and deputy head of Russia's military intelligence for the attack on Sergei Skripal and his daughter Yulia. EU foreign policy chief Federica Mogherini says that this is consistent with the current EU policy.
We started to discuss opportunity to have a sanctions regime in place specific to the use of chemical weapons already in the previous months. So the decision today has come to somehow fill in the list that was already open for possibility.
Moscow dismissed the sanctions as groundless, and Russia has denied charges it was behind the nerve agent attack on the Skripals. A suicide bomber in Syria has targeted a convoy of U.S. and allied Kurdish forces in the second attack against U.S. forces in the past week. U.S. military Colonel Sean Ryan said there were no casualties among the U.S.-led coalition members. Witnesses say the attack happened in the western edge of Shadadayad town, a route frequently used by the U.S.-led coalition fighting Islamic State militants. Meanwhile, Israel has launched strikes into Syria early Monday as part of its increasingly open assault on Iran's presence there. Grace Jerome with Reuters reports.
On Monday, fighter jets focused on the Iranian Quds force, targeting munitions stores, a site at Damascus International Airport, an intelligence site and a military training camp. At least 11 people are reported to have been killed, but Syrian state media said the country's Russian air defense system had intercepted and destroyed most of the targets. This video purportedly shows the Syrian army retaliating later on Monday. The Israeli strikes were launched in response to cross-border fire over the weekend, when Syria says it repelled an air attack and the Israeli Defense Forces reported shooting down a rocket fired at a ski resort in the Israeli-occupied Golan Heights.
That's Reuters' Grace Jerome reporting. Marathon talks to end a teacher strike in America's second-largest school district were reportedly making progress Monday, but the strike will continue until its sixth day Tuesday, even if a deal is reached, union representatives said. Some 30,000 teachers in the Los Angeles school district walked off the job on January 14th, demanding higher pay, smaller class sizes, and more support staff. More at voanews.com. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News. We'll be right back.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, January 22nd, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Internet has been restored in Zimbabwe after a court found the shutdown illegal.
If we are in the 21st century and people are being denied access by their government on some flimsy excuse, that is totally unacceptable.
Tabang Nare is a Zimbabwean who works with civil society groups in Zimbabwe. Zimbabwe's president cut short his foreign trip as fuel protests continue. Civil society groups urge Malawi's president to show evidence of an alleged plot to rig the coming May elections. Cameroon and China to improve relations amid exploitation complaints. And the WHO says migrants do not bring diseases into Europe.
The refugees and migrants who come to Europe, they do not bring any exotic communicable diseases. The diseases that they might have, they are all well-established diseases in Europe.
Susanna Jacob is the WHO Regional Director for Europe, and the much-anticipated Senegambia Bridge has opened. Those stories, plus our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Internet has been restored in Zimbabwe after the country's High Court Monday found the shutdown of internet services illegal. State Security Minister Owen Mbe ordered this shutdown last week as part of government efforts to quell violent anti-government protests against high fuel prices. But in its ruling, the High Court said the minister did not have the authority to order the shutdown. It said only President Emmerson Mnangagwa had the authority to issue such an order. Tabang Nare is a Zimbabwean who works with civil society groups in Zimbabwe. He says it is unacceptable in the 21st century for any government to deny its citizens the right to access the internet.
As a Zimbabwean, this was totally unnecessary for Zimbabweans to be cut off from the internet. It was a great inconvenience and real embarrassment in the world, because the assumption now is that the right to communicate is a basic right which everyone should have, which is why we have these mobile devices and we have internet. So if we are in the 21st century and people are being denied access by their government on some flimsy excuse, that is totally unacceptable.
The president, we understand, has cut short his visit and is returning to Zimbabwe. What do you expect he might do? Because the court said only he has the right to order the shutdown of the internet.
Well, knowing the president and what he has done in the past, you know, round about August 1, we know that the president said he did not know who had authorized the army to understand what was happening, which is why he put in place a commission. So his initial reaction might be he doesn't understand why people were denied access to social media, and he'll come out as a good man. But in real terms, they are working together. It's really, they have that joint responsibility as a government for the actions that they have taken.
One of the reasons that the State Security Minister, Owen Mbe, gave was that I think a way to control the protests.
The protest was a stay away, so people were staying in their home. And as you might have noticed through the briefing by the police and the security agents, they are now talking about rogue elements from the security agents, people who are deserters, people who are retired, who might have used army uniforms to beat up people. So in real terms, the majority of cases now appears might not have been ordinary citizens. But it looks like there might have been people who had a deliberate agenda, political opportunists who wanted to disturb the peaceful protest, you know, against the fuel price.
Tamang Nere is a Zimbabwean who works with civil society groups inside Zimbabwe. He was speaking with me from the U.S. city of Dallas in Texas. Zimbabwe President Emmerson Mnangagwa has cut short a foreign tour to deal with unrest over fuel prices. Police used force last week to crush protests triggered by the price of fuel being increased 150%. Columbus Mavunga has the story from Harare.
Zimbabwe President Emmerson Mnangagwa cut short his five-nation trip Monday after visiting Russia, Belarus, Kazakhstan, and Azerbaijan. He was supposed to end it by attending the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland. Instead, he is coming home to deal with the protests triggered by the government's fuel price hike last week. A local doctors' rights group said it had treated 68 gunshots and scores of cases of assault after Zimbabwe's security forces broke up protests in Harare and Bulawayo. Opposition supporters blamed police and army troops for the violence. During the weekend, officials said the gunfire and beatings were the work of rogue elements and not Zimbabwe's security forces. Meanwhile, on Monday, police arrested Zimbabwe Congress of Trade Unions leader Japheth Moyo as he tried to leave the country. He and another leader of the protests, Pastor Ivan Mawarire, are now facing subversion charges. Another 600 protesters are facing charges of violence. Morgan Comish, the vice chairman of the Movement for Democratic Change, MDC, accused the president of directing his security forces to beat and harass activists and labor leaders involved with the protests.
I was shocked. I don't expect any leader to behave in that manner. A good leader would always engage. Instead of taking up, you know, this heavy-handedness of bringing in the army, heavy police, armed police, violence, employing ZANU-PF youth to go and beat people in response to what people have said, it's unleadership, it's unpresidential.
Harare Polytechnic College senior journalism and international politics lecturer Alexander Rusero says the government is no different from the one led by former President Robert Mugabe.
It's uncalled for. It's very unfortunate. This government had a lot of expectations, aspirations, hopes by the people, but it is proving to be a false start.
Like what?
It's a false start because all the hopes, the last thing the people were supposed to do in Zimbabwe is to wish for Mugabe after 37 years of bastardizing this country.
Mnangagwa took power in November 2017 following Mugabe's forced resignation after 37 years in power. Columbus Mavunga for VOA News, Harare.
Civil society groups in Malawi have urged President Arthur Peter Mutharika to show evidence of an alleged plot to rig the coming May elections. The president alluded to the plot at a rally in the commercial capital Blantyre without naming the alleged masterminds. But he warned that rigging the polls is a criminal offense in Malawi. Critics say it appears the president and his ruling Democratic Progressive Party, the DPP, are in a panic mode after recent polls show them losing ground to opposition political parties. President Mutharika faces a tough challenge from opposition candidates, including his vice president, Saulos Chilima, who resigned from the ruling party to form his own party. Vincent Kondwe is a governance consultant and a member of the Political Science Association of Malawi.
There are several perspectives that one can draw from what the president has said. In the first place, he's an incumbent head of state. He's the commander-in-chief of the Malawi Defense Forces. The commander-in-chief, all the intelligence services, whether in the military, in the police, and the National Intelligence Service, they all report to the head of state. So when the head of state makes an allegation, instead of bringing facts and then tell the people about those facts which are coming from the security agencies, it becomes very, very surprising to say why should the head of state be making very serious allegations. So to most of us, it is quite a surprising thing. But again, from a layman's point of view, it only demonstrates that maybe there is a panic mode hovering around the ruling Democratic Progressive Party.
Some are also demanding that the president present his evidence of the plan by some of these political leaders to rig the election. What do you make of this?
They are quite justified. Let the president bring facts, like I alluded to. So he must come out in the open and tell the nation what kind of evidence he has, so that we can all go to the polls with an open mind that there will be contestation at the ballot box and not that there are some people who are planning to hijack the will of the people. the free suffrage of the people of Malawi.
Some are also saying that President Mutharika, during his rally at the commercial capital in Blantyre, said he is waiting and watching and that he will pounce on them when he is ready. Some are saying his rhetoric is not presidential. Supporters are saying that he is right to make clear that rigging the elections is a crime in Malawi. What is your take?
Well, rigging elections is a crime in Malawi. If he has evidence, let the police do their job. But as a head of state, he cannot go on the podium to threaten opposition operatives. To me, that is trying to shrink the political space so that there's no contestation of ideas. Malawi is a democratic state since 1992, 1993, when we voted for democratic politics. So people must vote individuals into office based on contestation of ideas. And people must be able to choose from the political market what ideas can best serve the interests of Malawians. So the president should not just go about using rhetoric that can provoke his supporters to be very, very violent, as we have seen over the past 1 month or so, against the opposition political party members.
Vincent Kondo is a member of the Political Science Association of Malawi. He spoke with viewers Peter Clotte from the capital, Lilongwe. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, January 22nd. Daybreak Africa time, 16 minutes past the hour. A new report by the World Health Organization disputes a belief that refugees and migrants bring exotic communicable diseases into the European region. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva at the launch of their first ever WHO report on the health of displaced people in Europe.
The report is based on evidence from more than 13,000 documents. It provides a snapshot of the health of refugees and migrants who comprise about 10% of the nearly 1 billion population in 53 European countries. The survey finds migrants and refugees are generally in good health, but due to poor living conditions, they risk falling ill while in transit or while staying in receiving countries. The report says, contrary to common perception, the risk of refugees and migrants transmitting communicable diseases to their host population is very low. The WHO Regional Director for Europe, Susanna Jakob, tells VOA, displacement itself makes refugees and migrants more vulnerable to infectious diseases.
The refugees and migrants who come to Europe, they do not bring any exotic diseases with them, any exotic communicable diseases. The diseases that they might have, they are all well-established diseases in Europe. And also, we have very good prevention and control programs for these diseases. This applies both for tuberculosis, but also HIV/AIDS.
Europe is the only one among WHO's six regions where HIV is prevalent and increasing, especially in the East. Jakob says a significant proportion of migrants and refugees who are HIV positive acquired the infection after they arrive in Europe. The report finds refugees and migrants seem to have fewer non-communicable diseases on arrival than their host populations. But it notes the longer they stay in the countries in conditions of poverty, their risk of cardiovascular diseases, stroke, and cancer increases. The report says refugees and migrants are more affected by depression and anxiety than host populations. It says unaccompanied minors are vulnerable to sexual exploitation and suffer from higher rates of depression and symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder. WHO considers it critically important that European countries provide quality and affordable health care for all refugees and migrants, regardless of their legal status. Providing universal health coverage, it says, would significantly improve the well-being of both the displaced and host populations. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Chinese President Xi Jinping's special representative was in Cameroon this past weekend to improve relations between the two countries. Trade and security ties have steadily grown between Beijing and Yaoundé, but tensions between Cameroonian and Chinese miners have given China a bad name. Moki Edwin Kinzika reports from the eastern town of Bitari, Oya.
when Cameroonian President Paul Biya hosted China's special representative, Yang Jiechi, on Friday, both men had nothing but good things to say. Biya welcomed China's Belt and Road Initiative, Beijing's multi-billion dollar plan to connect Asia, Europe, and Africa. Yang said bilateral relations had reached a new starting point with important development opportunities. When asked by a reporter for VOA about the common belief that Chinese are exploiting Cameroon, Yang called it a misunderstanding. He says Cameroon and China need to work closely to make their people realize that they stand to benefit a lot. But while Yang visited the capital, about 60 Cameroonian miners protested outside a Chinese-run gold mining operation in the village of Ngura. The miners have blocked access to the site since Thursday. Protesting miner Patrice Wuyu says that Chinese competition exploits and destroys Cameroon's natural resources.
Les textes sont clairs. Y a pas d'activité minière.
He says Chinese miners violate Cameroon laws, which prohibit mining on riverbeds, swampy areas, and waterfalls. They will keep this mining site closed, he says, until the government forces the guilty miners to face justice. Protest leader Rigo Bengum says the Chinese bribe corrupt Cameroon officials to overlook their code violations. He says they also lure teenagers out of school to dig for gold.
L'entrepreneur, l'homme d'affaires de l'Est, y gagnerait.
Gum says he is surprised that the government gives mining licenses to the Chinese when there are qualified Cameroonians who own mining enterprises and are ready to industrialize their country. But while mining remains a contentious issue, Cameroon's Minister of the Economy, Planning and Regional Development disputes the notion that China simply exploits. China is Cameroon's primary investor, according to the ministry, putting more than $400 million per year into the country's roads, dams, telecommunications, stadiums, and housing projects. Critics note much of the investment goes towards assessing Cameroon's natural resources, while the country is at growing risk of debt distress. But ministry spokesman Alamin Usman May says China is beginning to offer more help than in the past. Beijing in November, he notes, gave Yaounde aid equal to $3 million to help people displaced by Cameroon's separatist crisis in English-speaking region.
We are very pleased that our partners like China are offering humanitarian support. Up to 1.8 billion CFA material, we have signed the letter of exchange to supply to these two regions.
China's special envoy, Yang, during his visit, announced the cancellation of about $5 million of Cameroon's debt as well, though the remaining amount owed was not clear. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Betari Oya, Eastern Cameroon.
The much-anticipated Senegambia Bridge linking northern and southern Gambia is now open. The bridge stretches nearly 1.8 kilometers across the Gambia River. Regional analysts say it will ease transportation delays and the free movement of goods and services and speed up integration between Senegal and the Gambia, as well as the West African region as a whole. Pandere Umbaye reports.
Thousands of people gathered Monday for opening of the landmark bridge. President Adama Barrow spoke.
The inaugural ceremony of this bridge marks one of the happiest moments in my presidency and a historic day in the Gambia and the sub-region. As a result, it is a unique privilege and honor for me to perform the noble task of the official opening.
The idea of constructing a bridge on the River Gambia was conceived 4 decades ago during Sir Dawda Kairaba Jawara's rule of Gambia. But the idea died due to economic and sovereignty concerns following a failed confederation between the two countries in 1989. Senegal pulled out of the confederation after accusing the Gambia of not living up to its terms, which sought, among other things, eventually uniting the countries.
Distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, given the geography of the Gambia and Senegal, with a river dividing both countries in two halves, I cannot help but wonder why it took so long to have a bridge at this point across the River Gambia. In spite of the delay, this magnificent bridge will henceforth be a major component of the Trans-Gambia Corridor, a corridor that is essential for development, integration, trade expansion within the ECOWAS sub-region.
The bridge project was finalized during former President Yahya Jammeh's rule, despite the strained relationship between the two countries. There were times when Senegal closed its borders with the Gambia in retaliation for what Senegalese transporters call high ferry crossing fees and harassment from the Gambian side of the border. Relationships between the two countries improved immediately after President Adama Barrow came to power in December of 2016. Senegal's President Macky Sall acknowledged the improved relationship during his address to the gathering.
This bridge could not have been achieved without the political will and the leadership of the President Barrow. So, my dear brother, I extend to you and to the brotherly people of the Gambia my warmest congratulations for this outstanding achievement.
The bridge is a joint venture between the two countries with financing from the African Development Bank, ADB. The Gambia will be responsible for the bridge's maintenance and safety. Vehicles traveling on the bridge will pay toll fees. An official of the African Development Bank reaffirmed the bank's commitment to promoting African integration and free trade.
The bank is proud to have supported the government of the Gambia with approximately $90 million of grants, and the government of Senegal with approximately $4.5 million of a loan.
The Senegambia Bridge is part of the Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS Quest, to promote free movement of goods and people in the sub-region. Analysts say the bridge will facilitate interstate trade, especially among the Gambia, Senegal, Guinea-Bissau, Guinea-Conakry, Mali, Nigeria, Liberia, and Sierra Leone. For VOA Africa, this is Pandering by reporting.
Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir is set to go to Qatar this week, his first overseas trip since widespread anti-government protests rocked the nation. Bashir has tried to downplay the protests, insisting that foreign agents and infiltrators are responsible for the dissent, as well as the violence that has followed. Internet has been restored in Zimbabwe after the country's High Court Monday found the shutdown of internet services illegal. State Security Minister Owen Mbe ordered the shutdown last week as part of government efforts to quell violent anti-government protests against high fuel prices. But in its ruling, the High Court said the minister did not have the authority to order the shutdown. It said only President Emmerson Mnangagwa had the authority to issue such an order. And that is it for this Tuesday, January 22nd edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with our engineer Jimmy Cook, I am James Barty in Washington, wishing all of you in Africa a very good day.
Hello, I'm Lino Armoudou, host of Health Chat. Next week on Health Chat, we will discuss latest efforts to sustain the Global Fund to fight AIDS, TB, and malaria, the largest global partnership addressing the three diseases. Our guest is Elizabeth Ivanovich, Director for Global Health at the UN Foundation. For your questions or comments, email us at healthchat@voanews.com. You You can also reach us by phone to leave a message. Dial the international code for the United States, then dial 202-205-9942. The U.S. country code is 1. Dial 45 after you hear the station ID. Health Chat this Tuesday at 1730 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.